This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Vice Presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka says the Green Party will fight for the rights of all oppressed people. Blacks in Ferguson, Missouri suspect the cops are behind the killing of a young activist. And blacks in Colombia want to make sure that a peace deal between the government and rebels also safeguards the rights of African-descended peoples. But first, veteran anti-war activist David Swanson is urging corporate media networks and cable channels to hold their own debates that include the presidential candidates of the Green and Libertarian parties.
There's a petition you can find at rootsaction.org. It's getting close to 20,000 signatures now. Maybe you can be number 20,000 if you go and sign it. And it has already been delivered and will continue to be resent to ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox Broadcasting, PBS, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, Univision, and Telemundo, asking them to do their jobs, to cover a presidential debate, to hold a presidential debate with all the candidates that should appropriately be in it, and to ask them serious questions. NBC did this pseudo-debate with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton this week on nothing but war, war, and more war. And I wrote beforehand all of the most important things that one could be asked about peace or war, knowing that none of them would be asked, and none of them were. And the networks have handed over to this private organization that has no legal standing whatsoever, the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is nothing but a bipartisan teamwork coalition of the Republicans and the Democrats created to keep other candidates out and to keep any serious questions out and to set up all sorts of rules and avoid any surprises and anything difficult for the poor, fragile candidates. So we're suggesting that the debates should be open, and this is something that was recommended by a citizens task force at American University Law School. They should be open to any candidate who's already on enough ballots in enough states to win and who is either at 5% in the polls or has a majority saying they should be in. There have been some polls done already, and clearly a majority wants Jill Stein and Gary Johnson in the debates. And because I want Jill Stein in the debates, I want Gary Johnson too, because, you know, it's more likely to work out that they would add someone seen as from the left and someone from the right. But just adding Jill Stein would create an entirely different conversation, whole other topics and facts and discussions that just won't be there with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
Well, what does it say about the corporate media that they would abdicate their own responsibilities in favor of a tag team of Republicans and Democrats and allow them to monopolize the discourse?
It says something about the incredible disorganization of the Republican Party, because the Republican Party didn't nominate Donald Trump. The media outlets nominated Donald Trump by giving him dozens of times the coverage of any other candidate in either party, because they thought it was good for ratings. But now it comes time, you know, having accomplished that, and the world be damned, and who cares the results, now comes the time for a debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and there's no question that it would be good for their ratings to add other candidates to those debates. There are millions and millions of people in the United States and probably elsewhere who would watch if Jill Stein and Gary Johnson were in there, but can't stand Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. I mean, these are the two least popular nominees from these parties ever. And Donald Trump is hurting himself in the polls right now because he loves attention so much, while Hillary Clinton is helping herself by hiding and avoiding the press. But they are so despised. The ratings would be great for the networks if they would just add more candidates, and they won't do it because they want to bow down to the power of the Democratic and Republican parties. So if the Republican Party had had its act together earlier and put pressure on the networks for more coverage and better coverage of some other candidate other than Donald Trump, well, that person would have gotten the nomination. Just as the media outlets collaborated with the DNC, and we know this explicitly from emails now, in hurting Bernie Sanders and making sure Hillary Clinton got the nomination. So the Republican Party didn't have its act together, and now they're stuck with Donald Trump. But the rest of us are stuck with this pair of walking catastrophes. And, you know, I can't stand to watch them. I avoided watching their war discussion Wednesday night. I had the opportunity to watch the new Snowden movie instead, and I was much better off. My mental health, I think, was superior to anyone who subjected themselves to those people. Put Jill Stein in the debate, and I'll watch it.
There are statistical reasons to believe that Donald Trump would actually do better in a four-way race than in a two-way race. So why doesn't he make the demand?
I'm not sure if he sees it that way himself. I don't know how conclusive those statistics are. There is a precedent. Ronald Reagan wanted John Anderson in the debate, and clearly if one of the or both of the big party candidates said to open up the debates would be opened up. Donald Trump is incredibly unpredictable. He would have to see it as in the interest of his ego that somehow his face would be on the camera more seconds if there were four people on stage than two people on stage. And I don't know how that could be worked out. I mean, this is someone who just wants immediate gratification of attention and flashbulbs and eyeballs more than anything else. I think if he could have a debate with just himself on the stage and he had to debate himself and take contrary opinions on everything, which he does anyway, he'd prefer that to having a two-person debate. So I don't know that he's going to come out for that, but I think the media outlets, even one media outlet, even CNN, for example, ought to have the decency to step forward and say, you know what, we're not going to have a debate unless these four candidates are in it, and we're going to have one, two, or three empty chairs depending on who shows up. And this is the debate, and we're going to ask serious questions, and we're not going to tell you what they are beforehand. Let's go. Or civic groups and organizations or the campaigns themselves should have the decency to just set up a debate and let it be on C-SPAN and everybody's YouTube and iPhone video and leave the networks out of it. They don't contribute anything. They have nothing to add to the value of a debate. They just put their inane chatter over top of it. It's much better if it's also on C-SPAN. So there are easy solutions here, small d democratic solutions, but we have a very corrupt system, even if it's bizarrely and incompletely corrupt, and we end up with this pair of candidates.
The corporate media are, of course, complicit in making it impossible for third-party candidates to achieve the 15% goal set arbitrarily by the Democrats and Republicans for participation in those debates. The Pew Research Center has found that the networks and the cable broadcasters dedicate only 0.5% of their time to covering Jill Stein and Gary Johnson's campaigns.
Yes, far worse than the discrimination against covering Bernie Sanders' campaign. Jill Stein and Gary Johnson are essentially whited out of the media. I mean, when I talk to anyone, I go to the doctor or I talk to someone on the street, what comes up in conversation within 5 minutes every time? Because I'm in the United States of election obsession America, the damn election. But I can't find anybody who's even heard of Jill Stein or Gary Johnson. They don't know who they are. It all comes down to name recognition and extremely low information in the U.S. public. This is why Donald Trump can get away with making a complete ass of himself in the eyes of everybody who obsesses with politics. And it doesn't show up in the polls, in part perhaps because most people just don't know. And most people don't care and can't stand to pay attention. A lot of people even who will bother to vote, half the country won't bother, but people who will bother to vote avoid the whole unpleasantness of these people up until then. So the details don't really matter. But were media outlets to get Jill Stein and Gary Johnson and policy issues with major debates over them before the eyes and the ears of the public, there would be some interest. I mean, who wouldn't want to vote on whether or not to have disastrous corporate trade agreements, whether or not to have disastrous wars, whether or not to scale back the military and invest that unfathomable pile of money in the things we don't dare dream of. I mean, we saw when the media cracked open a little bit for Bernie Sanders, we saw incredible interest in what he had to say. And Jill Stein says everything Bernie Sanders had to say, plus better, but nobody knows it. And it's very hard for anybody to know it or to understand that they should care when the media has informed them that third parties don't matter.
Yes, if there were a four-way debate, three of the candidates would be against regime change, if you believe Donald Trump at least half of the time, what he says half of the time, leaving Hillary Clinton alone as the regime-changing humanitarian warfare specialist.
Yeah, well, I don't believe Donald Trump. That's the thing. Donald Trump made a very clear during the interviews on NBC on Wednesday night that he is promising war, war, war. And Hillary Clinton, of course, is quite open, you know, bragging about her role in all the disastrous wars of the past 15 years and more and promising more of them. And the pair of them are a disaster. Gary Johnson and the libertarian position, of course, is not to spend money on things, you know, and wars cost more money than everything else put together. So he has to favor scaling the wars back at least a little to be at all consistent as a libertarian. And to his credit, he has said as much. But he also favors no money for parks, no money for schools, no money for trains, no money for green energy, no money for healthcare, et cetera, because all of those good things cost money. This is my problem with war, that you're putting $1 trillion a year or more, the United States alone, into preparing for war every year, when $30 billion, which is like an invisible speck of a fragment of $1 trillion, according to the United Nations, would end starvation and hunger on the planet, $30 billion a year. So if you're not going to put any of the money into anything useful, you're just going to stop spending it on some of the things disastrous. That's not really a coherent solution to the mess we're in. But yes, to have Gary Johnson speaking against this endless war making and building up of hostility and the new Cold War and the weapons industry and the regime changes with Jill Stein and perhaps Donald Trump not so credibly and consistently joining in, that would be terrific, to have Hillary Clinton on a stage where she has to stand alone against a majority, and of course majority opinion in the public in the United States and the world, and say, no, you're all wrong, we need more wars. That would be terrific, and of course Hillary Clinton won't do that if she can help it in any way.
And in terms of name recognition, a recent CNN poll showed that 36% of the public never heard of Jill Stein, and 32% of the public never heard of Gary Johnson.
That's not bad if the other percentages have heard of them. That's better than Dennis Kucinich was doing in the Democratic Party primary at a point that I can recall. If you've got two-thirds that have actually heard of them and can identify who they are, that's remarkable when, those candidates themselves, in the case of Gary Johnson, can't identify the city of Aleppo. They should have asked him, are you in favor of bombing Aleppo, rather than have you ever heard of Aleppo or know where it is? Because that's the easier question for a presidential candidate. But, most Americans don't know anything about anything. So if two-thirds have heard of Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, I would consider that relative progress, considering, our communication system.
Yes, considering they get only 0.5% of the campaign coverage.
Right, because, near 100% of people have heard of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and have some vague notion of who they are and why one is less horrible than the other. And very close to that percentage have had beaten into their heads year after year after decade, that the only reasonable vote is for one of the two big parties, that you cannot go and vote for anyone else responsibly. And so they believe they have to figure out which of those two is a little bit less horrendous than the other and go hold their nose and vote for them and start, in many cases, to convince themselves that their pick is a little less horrible than it appears. Whereas, in fact, you could have a fraction of the people who can't stand Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump go and vote for Jill Stein and she could win. That's doable. It's just a question of that possibility isn't admitted into public discourse in the big media cartel. It has to be through decent media outlets like this one.
So it appears that the last stand of the duopoly system is, of course, money and the corporate media itself.
I agree. If it is the last stand, though, that would be wonderful news. That we'll see. It remains to be seen. But it is a question of the incredible power of these parties. We think of Congress members as corrupted by money, but most of that money goes through one of the two big parties. We think of the television networks as corrupted by advertisers and by wanting access to guests. But who controls much of that advertising budget and access to those guests? These two big parties. These are the two branches of the U.S. government. There's not a legislature anymore. There's not a judiciary anymore. There's not an executive. There's a commander-in-chief of all of us, as if we're all in the military. And the traditional three branches that we're told about aren't really there anymore. What's there are these two branches that don't exist in the Constitution or any law. And of course, when they collaborate on the Commission on Presidential Debates, that doesn't exist in the Constitution or any law, but they have effectively this power and they aren't afraid to exercise it. And until those of us who've rejected those two parties get it into our heads that we can do something else, that we can exercise our energy and our powers as activists outside of elections, which is where change always comes, even when an election system is better than this one. And to the extent that we inevitably obsess over elections, well, then go and vote for a decent candidate, for goodness sake. Well, then we're going to be trapped in this new arrangement of the U.S. government that's divided between these two parties that agree not only on the rules of debates, but on military spending, the necessity of having more wars, the irrelevance of taking serious action to protect the Earth's climate, the uselessness of meeting basic human rights to education and health care and income as rights rather than privileges. There is incredible agreement between these two parties, just as between the five or six companies that control what we learn about them. So we need to break up all of these monopolies.
And folks can sign this petition by going to rootsaction.org.
Yes, exactly, and please do.
That was David Swanson speaking from Washington. The Green Party held a massive rally in Chicago recently for Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka, their candidates for president and vice president. Baraka says the people are demanding answers to some serious questions.
Why can't we have jobs to pay a living wage and provide us with dignity? Why is it that we have thousands of people in various cities who every night don't know where they're going to lay their head, who have no roof over their head? Why is it that they are cutting back on our schools? Why is it that millions of people who would like to work full-time can't find a job? Why is it that in the city of Chicago, we have communities where basically 16 to 19-year-olds, we see that there's something like 60 and 70 and 80% unemployment?
Come on, that's right.
When people talk about, we need to deal with the issue of violence in the city, we understand that. But I say that if you're not talking about how we deal with these grinding economic and social conditions, I don't want to talk about the violence. If you don't have a plan on how we put people back to work, provide them dignity, adequate housing, health care, a clean environment, and respect for their fundamental human rights, then we have no conversation. All of these issues are linked. People say, Ajamu, they tell us that there is a recovery from the collapse of the, economy, where Wall Street basically destroyed the economy in 2008. They say, they say that there is a recovery. We see all these figures about unemployment being 4.something%, and that the jobs are coming back. But people are telling Jill and I that we don't see it, and we don't feel it. Recovery for who? Well, we know who has basically recovered. The same criminals that caused the problem in the first place. That is why this campaign is not just about pointing to that voting booth, as important as that is. This campaign is about building movement. It's about building an alternative to the status quo. It is recognizing that we are in a protracted struggle for fundamental change. But it's change that we have to make. So in this campaign, we say, we're not going to play with the people. We're not going to lie to the people. We're not going to compromise our principles, and we're not going to succumb to fear. When we say no lies, what we mean is that basically we are going to have intelligent conversations with the people. We're going to talk about the fact that we have some difficult days ahead of us. And that even though we have a very progressive platform, we understand we have to fight for that platform. We are not going to pander to the people with, you know, this false patriotism and this militaristic talk that we saw last night in that so-called commander-in-chief conversation. We're not going to do that. When organizations and movements say that they are fighting for justice, you know, we saw what happened with the Democrat Party when the Movement for Black Lives put out their platform and started making demands on the Democratic Party. Many of you saw that big memo in which the Democrats said, well, you know, when we are approached by Black Lives Matter, you know, in essence, just pat them on the head, you know. Don't make any demands. Don't allow them to make any demands. Don't give any agreements to their demands. Well, we're not going to do that if we don't do that. Because we recognize that we have to have all movements, and we have to have respect, and that everybody has a voice. And we're going to make sure that they have a voice. Because we have to stand shoulder to shoulder in this struggle for liberation. So we're not going to pander to the people. We know that, for example, Hillary Clinton pretends to be opposed to TPP. Now look, that's pandering. Because if you understand her history, her ideological orientation, you know that she is lying. She is a neoliberal capitalist, and she supports so-called. We remember that another popular candidate pretended to be opposed to NAFTA, and in fact told all of us that once he was elected, he was going to renegotiate the terms of NAFTA, and that individual was, of course, Barack Obama, and we saw what he did. No compromise. No compromise. We say that basically, when we assume office, we're not going to be the managers of this corrupt system. We are not going to turn our back on our commitments. We will struggle to implement a living wage. We will eliminate student debt. We will move the economy to a green economy. We will bring decision making back to the people. We will restore democracy here in this country.
Ajamu Baraka, vice presidential candidate for the Green Party and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. In the last 2 years, lots of people have relearned the lesson that there's more to politics than just voting for Republicans or Democrats. Social movements have blossomed, and black politics is reasserting itself. The new African Independence Party recently held its annual conference in Pittsburgh. We spoke with one of the party's leaders, Khalid Rahim.
One of the first issues that we dealt with was around police brutality and misconduct, police brutality and terror, and proliferation of police brutality and terror all across the country, namely here within the city of Pittsburgh and the surrounding county, Allegheny County. We have a police union that's in the forefront, maintaining a serious, violent, and racist and white supremacist type of police presence. I do give some credit to the newly installed police chief. He's trying to do certain things to make it easier for the surrounding communities as they interact with the Pittsburgh Police Department. But just recently, for example, the SOP, Fraternal Order of Police, they took a vote on what they thought of the recently installed police chief, and they came back with a no-confidence vote. Now, he was also criticized when he spoke at the Democratic Party National Convention, and he talked about the need for better relationships between the people in the police department. So I give him some credit for making an honest effort to try to bridge the gap in terms of police reform. But we all know that in order for any substantial changes to come about, we really, really have to have community control of the police. And that means we have to dismantle the current system and replace it with something that's basically controlled and ran by the people themselves.
Well, has your organization been discussing various forms of community control and trying to figure out which one would fit in Pittsburgh?
Well, we wrote a letter about a year or so ago that was distributed to local public officials and politicians as well as the U.S. Attorney General. And we called for some specific reforms to take place. This was in light of the anniversary, if you want to call it an anniversary, of the murder of Michael Brown up in Ferguson, Missouri. So we had developed an apparatus to speak to issues of police brutality and terror that we developed through the leadership of the New African Independence Party. And that apparatus or umbrella group is called the National Mobilization Against Police Brutality and the FOP. Because we think that it's very important to zero in and focus on the relationship between police brutality, terror, and the so-called police union, namely the FOP, which is very dominant here within our area. The FOP, for example, was actually founded in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, over 100 years ago in 1915. And so when they had their 100th anniversary conference here in Pittsburgh last year, we took it upon ourselves through the party's leadership and through the mobilization effort to have a protest here within the city of Pittsburgh, protest against the FOP's presence and a protest against FOP's policies and practices that result in police brutality and terror, especially directed towards communities of color, notably the black community or the New African community.
Black activists in Washington, D.C. and in New York City a couple of months ago occupied the offices of police labor unions in their cities.
Right. And we heard about that. We certainly supported that. And we certainly applaud those efforts. We think that all throughout the country, all of those cities that have experienced, especially recent acts of police terror and violence, need to confront these so-called police unions, whether it's the Benevolent Patrolmen's Association or whether it's the Fraternal Order of Police. Certain unions are dominant depending on what part of the country people happen to be living in. So if you're living in the New York area, I think you have to deal with the Policemen's Benevolent Association or the PBA. If you're living in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia and other places, it's the FOT. But they all basically do the same thing. They push the line that the police department should not be touched, that the police department should have carte blanche right to murder people, to beat people up, to terrorize people under the flimsiest of excuses, such as I feared for my life, or I thought they had a gun, I thought they had a weapon. Oftentimes, no guns, no weapons are found. And the only people who were fearful were the people who were victimized and oftentimes murdered.
This mass black incarceration regime could not have become the monstrosity that it has become over the last 40 years without some degree of collaboration from the black political class. Is that the case in Pittsburgh?
Yes, you're absolutely correct. One of the things that is very unique about Pittsburgh when it comes to politics is that Pittsburgh, unlike Philadelphia, for example, Pittsburgh has never had a black mayor. Pittsburgh, unlike Cleveland, has never had a black mayor. Pittsburgh, unlike New York, has never had a black mayor. So the demographics here within Pittsburgh could justify having a black mayor, but Pittsburgh reminds you more of what America looked like and what white America looked like in the early 1900s to mid-1970s. We have a black population here that is kept under the pressure of white supremacy some on a regular basis. Yes, we do have some black elected public officials, but those black elected public officials are all members of the Democratic Party for the most part, and they're more loyal to the Democratic Party than they are loyal to the black or the new African community. And so just like the other cities around the country, you may have basically large numbers of black and brown politicians and public officials elected or appointed, but they don't really represent the interests of the black community, the brown community, or other people of color, or the poor people. They represent the interests of corporate America. They represent the interests of a particular political party, basically status quo, elitist parties, as you call them, the black leadership class. And so we have to deal with the same tendencies and same practices here within Pittsburgh as well.
And what electoral plans does the New African Independence Party have?
Well, for us, we think it's very important that we push forward and that we urge people to practice independent black politics, revolutionary black politics, that either you can join the NAIP or you can start your own independent black political party. But we have to create vehicles that will support our interests. You know, it's not about supporting the interests of what you call a duopoly, the Republican Party and or the Democratic Party. As I wrote recently, if you look at history, basically the Republican Party failed the black community in the post-Reconstruction era, and the Democratic Party has failed the black community in the post-Civil Rights era. So it's time for us as black people to take our cues from history and to move on, which means for us we have to create our own independent political vehicles for change. So we plan on running candidates for various campaigns on a local level. We think that everything is political, from who picks up the trash and garbage on the street to how folks interact with their community, such as the law enforcement folks. So for us, it's all political, and we have to act that way. We want to run candidates for different offices on the local level, on the regional level, and then perhaps on the statewide level. One of the things that we concluded some years ago, which led to us starting the NAIP, is that for us as black people, when we engage in various struggles for justice or for freedom, we continue to neglect the era of electoral politics. So we would march, we protest, we demonstrate, we throw rocks, bottles, and bricks. But when it came time to pull a lever or push a button for those people who engage in that type of political activity, we would concede that space to the two mainstream political parties. Oftentimes, we would concede that space to the Democratic Party. And so you and I both know what that leads to and what it has led to. We concede that space to the same forces that are basically responsible for our continued oppression and exploitation. I think that the conference that we had, I think it was a good event. We were able to bring people together from different parts of the country, people who are definitely concerned about working together and building principled unity, not unity just based on philosophy and ideology, but unity based on working together and getting things done. We certainly have some things to work on in terms of how we can make that type of conference or gathering even more productive. We do agree, however, that there is a definite need for us to put together and to further develop a network of independent black political action. And so that's something that all of us are definitely committed to.
That was Khalid Rahim of the New African Independence Party in Pittsburgh. The party is affiliated with the Black Is Back Coalition. 29-year-old black political activist Darryl Seal's body was found shot and burned inside his car in Ferguson, Missouri last week. No one's been charged in Seal's murder, but folks on the street suspect that the police are involved. We spoke with Edwin Chanel, whose New Generation Black Council works with gang members in the St. Louis area. Chanel was a close associate of Revolutionary Black Panther Party local leader Hudari Julani, also known as Angelo Brown, who was shot to death by cops in nearby Belleville, Illinois, earlier this year. Chanel also collaborated with Darren Seals and believes the cops played a role in his death.
Brother was a good brother, all-around brother. He worked for GM, wasn't a gang member, was a drug dealer. He was an activist for the streets, you feel me? He was trying to bring the community together. Anytime you came to him and wanted to talk about the issues, he was down for it. He never turned nobody away. He'd give you the clothes off his back. Honestly, I feel like it was a hit. The word on the streets is somebody paid $10,000 for it to happen, for it to go away.
What would be the motive and who would be putting out that kind of hit?
Caucasian. He was talking real powerful a week before. He was with Roc Nation. He was doing music videos, bringing awareness to the streets. I got a strong feeling it was police motivated, white folks motivated. For it to happen the way it did, for him to get shot in the head and for his truck to be burnt to charcoal like that, and nobody tried to stop it. Not only did he get lost his life, a woman also got killed. The only eyewitness got shot in the head the same day, the same night, the same time. Nobody's talking about it. It swept under the rug. $10,000 to a broke man, to a poor person, to anybody is a lot. But I do believe they paid a black person to carry out the hit. Like, I run NGBC, that's New Generation Black Council, Nation of Gangsters, Bloods, and Crips, and Families. And I'm just losing people left and right that I'm close to. So it's just a matter of time until I'm next. So I'm preparing for it. I done put out life insurance for my kids. They're really eliminating us, you know, not only in the penitentiary, but out here in the free world, and ain't nothing happening. So any life loss is a tragic situation. But this brother, this one brother that I seen big things coming from, and they took his life, and it was just a direct hit. Went out to the little visual the other day, and they still had casings on the ground. So where they do that at? So that was another message that they were sending clearly.
That is that the crime scene wasn't even processed. There were still bullet casings on the ground being walked upon by the observers.
Yes. So where they do that at? You know, we're better off not having a damn president, because even with a black president, we got more murders and they're videotaping it and nothing happening. So people out here is ready to take matters into their own hands, even though we know we're outpowered and outnumbered, but there's nothing ever came to us peacefully. We just don't know who's next. They don't want the Mike Brown situation to happen again, and they're going to do anything in their power to do so. Like right now, they got something going on. I seen the 100-plus police blocking off Kings Highway, the same Kings Highway we shut down for my brother's murder. So they're planning something big, and we waiting on them. Only thing we have on our side is guerrilla warfare. We're going to use our community in our favor. So like Marcus Garvey, you know, Marcus Garvey didn't have internet, didn't have phones, but he mobilized millions of people, and they got on the same page. So that's what we're doing, and that's what Darren Shields was doing. And just a matter of time, I mean, I'm not going to beat nobody rug where they can just step all over me. Darren Shields wasn't about that. He's about peace. I mean, all the way peaceful. And we see what that get us.
Edwin Chanel of the New Generation Black Council in St. Louis, Missouri. Colin Kaepernick's name is by now a household word after the football player's refusal to stand and honor the national anthem. But 31 years ago, Hardy Williams lost his position as a Los Angeles high school coach when he turned his back on the national anthem. Williams sued his school principal and the school district and won a $25,000 settlement. The lifelong educator says he'd been shunning the flag and the anthem for years before the authorities finally took action against him in 1985.
I've been here at Los Angeles High School. It's the oldest high school in the city of Los Angeles since 1973. And from that point on, I've been doing this since 1973. But 1985, that's when Mr. Patrick DeSantis, the principal at that time, I mean, I didn't make a big deal about it. So evidently saw me doing it. And then that's when it everything hit the fan.
1973, that's 5 years after Tommy Smith and John Carlos made their stand at the Mexico City Olympics.
Yes, 1973 is when I first started teaching here. I've been doing it here or any place, athletic events, any place where they play the national anthem or they have the Pledge of Allegiance. I mean, I don't honor it. I don't honor it. I mean, in my opinion, America doesn't honor us. So that's just my way of putting it bluntly. I would be one of the first to stand if the words of the Pledge of Allegiance and the anthem itself was true. I would have no problem with that. But if you are a person of color, we can go back to Native Americans, the indigenous ones here in the United States. If I were to face the flag or give honor to it, it would just hurt me too badly. And I can't do that. I can't do that. I'm for right. I'm for justice. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror.
Well, they fired you for it, but you took them to court.
Yes. Now, the situation, it could not bother my teaching job. My teaching job, it didn't affect that. But as far as coaching, principals in the L.A. Unified, they have, it's their prerogative. Anything extracurricular, like coach, band director, academic decathlon director, anything extracurricular is up to the principal at his or her discretion. I don't like the way you tie your shoes. Their discretion, they can remove you. So the principal, he felt that was his duty, and he did. But I guess he thought I was going to take it lying down. Coaching is very, very dear to me. I mean, I love it dearly, and I just could not do it. So that's correct. He fired me from my position at the time. I was assistant head football coach, and then later on I became the head coach. But that was the situation in a nutshell.
And what kind of support did you get from your peers or not get from your peers?
That's a very good question. My attorney, Theodore Egan, he was one of my good friends through high school. I came to Dorsey High School here in Los Angeles. And so when I did this, I went around to my fellow teachers and I asked them, and plus I had like an affidavit that later on that I took to court, that did they see anything wrong with what I did? And if they didn't mind, would they sign this affidavit, which was naturally in writing? And I had over 30 teachers, they signed it. And the thing which it didn't surprise me, I had more white teachers sign it than I did blacks.
Now, you ultimately prevailed in court and you got a $25,000 settlement, but even the judge didn't like what you did.
Oh, no, not at all, because prior to the court date, we tried to seek an injunction that would allow me to coach until the case came on trial. But Judge Cole denied the injunction, and he was one of the more conservative justices in the Los Angeles area. And when he made his decision, he vehemently said, "I don't like it one bit. I don't like it one bit," turning his back to the flag. "But that is Mr. Williams' constitutional right." And he said, "Mr. Egan, what do you want for your client?"
Now, I read that your mother, who's now 99 years old, wasn't pleased with you taking that stand. Is she proud of you now?
Well, my mother, I have three other siblings. The mother's always proud of me, and she was proud of me then. She was just afraid what the repercussions would bring. And she was correct. I know now, naturally, she's smiling from ear to ear.
Now, this confrontation that you had on the job happened in 1985. Has the environment, as far as you can see, changed much since then?
Of course not. Very little in my eyes. It has changed, not only here in the LA Unified School District, but throughout the United States. I'm just one individual, but I can't see how so many people of color would actually except the Star Spangled Banner, written by Francis Scott Key. Francis Scott Key, his father-in-law, owned Frederick Douglass. And there is the part of the anthem that states about slaves. They never say that. They never state that. If people would read history, I couldn't see why they would not have the same sentiments as myself. If they are true to themselves, it just makes me very upset. And I know, you know, individuals have their own personal reason for doing that, and that's actually their right. But monetary value, you hear it all the time, especially with people of notoriety, their brand. They want to protect their brand. That is what they care more about than standing up for right. And they will continue to do this until they read more, get more interested in what's actually going on around them. And I think that's what Kaepernick has done. Anytime you start reading, that's why your reading is so important. And athletics is very good, but in my opinion, too many of our youth, they just look at that as a way out. The atmosphere, hopefully it will change, but overall, I've seen very little change that has occurred here in the United States as far as people of color are concerned.
And how'd you feel when you saw what Kaepernick did to express his disdain for that Star Spangled Banner?
I was very, very, very elated. I knew at the time I was getting one of my automobiles serviced, and my brother, he had called me on the phone, and he said, "Did you hear about Kaepernick?" I said, "Did you hear about Kaepernick?" I said, "No, what are you talking about?" He said, "At the game last night, he refused to stand for the anthem." I said, "What?" And I said, "Oh, man, very good." And I immediately said, "He's my favorite player."
And have you tried to communicate with Mr. Kaepernick?
Well, I have the word out, and so like a few individuals that I know in the Bay Area. So I think hopefully I'll be able to meet him. I hope that is possible.
On September 26th, the Colombian government and FARC guerrillas will sign a peace deal to bring an end to more than 50 years of civil war. Shortly afterwards, a national referendum will be held on the peace deal. However, Afro-Colombians and indigenous peoples worry that their rights may be disregarded in the process. Charo Mina Rojas is a spokesperson for the Afro-Colombian struggle to maintain their territorial rights.
This is a very important move right now that the government and FARC has taken. Because, you know, part of these agreements have to do with Afro-descendant and indigenous territories. For instance, right now, right after September 26, where the agreements are officially signed. And then on October the 2nd, when there is a referendum where the civil society says yes to those agreements, we agree with that and we agree with the peace process, then it's going to start the implementation of those agreements. And the implementation of those agreements implies, for instance, that the guerrilla groups are going to be concentrated in certain areas that are very close to black and indigenous territories. And we are right now urging the government to sit down and have discussions about how the protocols of those processes are going to happen. But there are also agreements that have to do with reorganizing the territory, reorganizing politically and economically areas where FARC is going to be located, that again is going to be close, nearby, or passing through Afro-descendant of indigenous territories. So these are a series of events and actions and agreements and projects and legislation that is going to be happening that is going to have a direct impact or some kind of impact on the rights of Afro-descendant and indigenous people. So we are still, although there are agreements, concerned on how the implementation process is going to happen and how is that we ensure that we are part of any decision that is part of this process of implementation.
Do you expect the organizations that you work with to vote yes during that referendum? And do you expect most Black Colombians to approve of the peace process?
Oh, absolutely. All Black Colombians have been involved, and our organizations have been involved in ensuring that these peace talks happened. In fact, we used, with the indigenous also, publicly express our interest or help in any way to move on with the conversations with another guerrilla group that is active in the territories, which is the ELN. So we have been involved on all these issues of peace since the moment that they are talking. We were part of the groups and the organizations that push for those talks, and we definitely want to see peace in the territory. So we are voting C, we are campaigning for a C, and we are working against forces that are decided to sabotage the possibility of building up final peace in the country.
You had expressed anxiety that some of the FARC guerrillas would not agree to lay down their arms and could present problems for Afro-Colombians.
Yes, unfortunately, we know that there are sections of the guerrilla groups that won't be interested on giving up their arms and the territorial control and the economic control and the, some economic activities they have in the territories. So that's definitely a source of anxiety, some concern. But we also have a great concern with a very active mobilization of what we see as paramilitary groups kind of returning and making themselves more visible in the territories. And some actions have been seen already with the assassination of indigenous in Nariño and Cauca. So we have concern that this idea of peace is not embraced by everybody, particularly those who are actively engaged in violent actions in the territories, and we expect that the government take this decided actions and be very aware and very vigilant of how to deal with that situation.
What are your greatest concerns in terms of a comprehensive peace process, a comprehensive agreement among all the parties? What are the most important interests that Afro-Colombians need to protect?
Participation. Definitely, we have to be part of the conversations, of the agreements, of the implementation, of the verification processes. Now that they're with the agreements that are in place and with the conversations and the actions that may come with groups, we need to be part of those processes, active, present part that can be part of the decision-making processes. Because the problem with these things is that even if the groups discuss the issues and even if they take into account that peace agreements have to be considering and respecting the rights of Afro-descendant people, nobody but us is going to defend properly those rights and those interests and those priorities. So that is one of the main interest concerns, and our priority is be participating actively in all the actions and all the processes and all the decision-making processes so we can ensure that effectively the rights of Black people are protected.
And among those rights is the right to lands.
Yes, that's the right to land. It's one of the priorities that we have. It's one of the rights that we must protect because it's at the center of all the negotiations, it's at the center of the actions, it's at the center of all the interests. The territories where Afro-descendants is located mostly are at the center of the interests of these peace talks and at the center of war. For us, it's very important to be engaged on all those discussions, processes, decisions, so we make sure that the territories and the right to those territories is not affected by those decisions.
And what about the return of the millions of Colombians, disproportionately Black Colombians, who have been displaced by this war?
Well, that's one of the biggest concerns also in these discussions and in this process, because within the agreements, and we make sure that there are different provisions to ensure that, land needs to be acquired by the government to ensure the restitution of the territorial rights of people that have been displaced. And then we have to engage in a process of preparing the people that have been displaced and the communities to receive the people that have been displaced. It's going to be a long process. It's going to take a lot of organization, but mostly it's going to take a lot of real political will of government and FARC now to make sure that it's a peaceful, effective, peaceful process, and that all the elements that are needed in order to people return not only safely, but in conditions that they can rebuild their lives and their territories is going to happen. So we are moving as organizations on setting the demands for that, and we expect the opportunity to really sit down with the parts, and particularly with the government, to define the mechanisms in the legislation, if it's necessary, to ensure that that process happens.
That was Charo Mina Rojas of the Black Communities Process in Colombia. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the United States' best-known political prisoner, is making an appeal for Prison Radio, which carries his commentaries and reports from other activists locked up in the American Gulag.
I came in at 16 years old and had to grow up in prison. All my life, I didn't have a voice, but doing prison radio has saved my life.
I really appreciate prison radio because it's actually get the message and the word out and give people the opportunity to understand what is going on.
For this and its other works, it deserves your generous financial support at bit.ly/fightforprisoners. Thanks.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.